Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
This is a podcast where we examine the world through our own personal feminist perspectives. With that being said, we are not women's studies majors.
Nope.
We didn't study women's lib in college.
We didn't.
So we might get some facts wrong, especially with a episode like today's where we're talking about the suffragette movement and first wave feminism.
And there's also so much information.
I'm on information
overload.
We're
for sure gonna miss a lot of stuff.
For sure.
Because I could have gone into a black hole of first wave feminism this week.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. I generally really enjoy doing research. And I said that I didn't enjoy doing research this week, but it was so much.
It was a little stressful.
It was kind of stressful.
Well, and the other thing that was frustrating is that there was a lot of information, but then there really wasn't any information at the same time.
Yeah.
So you had to kind of dig a little bit and go down that rabbit hole a little bit in order to learn more information about stuff.
Yeah, you're kind of cobbling together stuff from multiple websites
and
videos and trying to figure out what's what and
exactly.
What goes where. It's very involved.
Yeah. Well, and I think that it's going to be easier for us when we do the second and third.
Yeah,
waves.
I think so, too. I think they're much more, straightforward.
Well, and there's so much more information on it. You know what I mean? This is, we're talking the 18th and 19th century, and not that we don't have a lot of information about those times, but I feel like it probably wasn't as, well-recorded
as
maybe...
Or the 19th and 20th century, more.
Oh, sorry. Yes, 18th. That's what I meant.
Yeah, I know. I do the same thing.
I get confused because when it's the 19th... when it's 1990-something, I want to say it's 19th century.
Yeah, I do the same thing. I do the exact same thing. I knew exactly what you meant.
Thank you. I appreciate it. You get me.
But... Yeah, so there's just, so much information. We tried to do a good job for you guys, so hopefully we did.
Yeah, we're just going to chat about it with the information that we have. We're not going to be hard on ourselves about, not getting it all. We're just going to chat about what we have.
Yeah.
And that's just life.
Okay, wonderful.
Okay.
Okay, where should we start?
Well, as I already said, it took place between, the 1800s and the 1900s, and I was watching... John Green video, the Crash Course of History YouTube videos, and he was saying that 1890 to 1920 people refer to as the women's era.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1900, almost 5 million women worked for wages in a lot of jobs like the garment industry and different things like that.
He said, when did it start?
He said between the 1890 and 1920.
That's so interesting, because it's so, again, this is part of what makes it so foggy and confusing,
mm-hmm.
is that I feel like everyone has kind of a different view and a different opinion on when the beginning of the movement happened.
Well, that's why that's the only specific dates as far as when the movement happened that I ever got. I was just seeing, 1800s, early 1900s, mm-hmm. and everything that I read. That was the only, kind of specific thing, so I wrote it down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, because I was actually looking, because usually people do, define things, and you find those brackets.
Yeah.
Those,
there's
time brackets.
Really, well, because also before, the movement started, there were, individual feminists that kind of, did their thing. So I guess people are probably okay, do we count that time, or do we count, when... the suffragette movement started. I'm sure that it's very foggy.
The most common theme that I found was that people tended to think that the American suffragette movement kind of really started getting ground and gaining ground in 1948 at the mm-hmm. Seneca Falls Convention.
Yeah.
But what I found was really interesting, I found this and I thought it was so fascinating and awesome and something that I didn't know, and now I kind of want to know more about Abigail Adams, who was John Adams's wife.
Right. Didn't you talk about her in an episode a minute ago?
I talked about Thomas Jefferson's wife.
Thank you.
Yeah. But John Adams, who is, his contemporary, Jefferson's contemporary, and also a person who wrote the Declaration of Independence, and he was one of our presidents, and... In the months leading up to the signing of the Declaration of Independence, Abigail Adams wrote her husband on March 31st, 1776, and this is what she said in the letter. She said, "In the new code of laws, which I suppose will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. Mm-hmm. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." So that was in 1776.
That's amazing.
Obviously, we didn't do that.
Yeah.
Like, American women didn't do that. But, I mean,
women... It was kind of like a premonition almost of, like, the future. No, we didn't do it immediately in 1776.
But women wanted to, man. Like, they were, were ready for rights, like, yeah, at that early stage.
I mean, honestly, I'm sure that even further back, it was just one of those things where it's like, how do we do this? How do we get a group of people together to really make change? I'm sure individually there were a lot of people that felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it just took some more time and getting a group of badass women together.
And getting men on your side.
Yeah.
Sadly, like, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, that's why allyship is important.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's good to have good men.
Yeah.
You know? We don't have any space for bad men. Well, I mean, so let's just mention that basically the first wave was a lot about gaining political power, including the right to vote, bringing about change in the political agenda, and a bit of reproductive rights. They touched on that a little bit.
Margaret Sanger came out of the first wave.
A lot of economic matters.
And during the first wave, I think it was in 1860. I don't know if I have it in my notes, but that was when women developed the right to own property, married women.
Yes.
Developed the right to own property and rights
wages
over their own children.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Which dual is, rights over their own children.
Right. Well, and that's kind of touching on something that the first wave was really all about. It was a lot about typical female roles, even though it was about, you know, gaining wages and political power and voting and things like that. It still was very much like a mother, middle class, mm-hmm, white mother kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. This
thing.
It was definitely led by white middle class women.
Right. So
and
because
upper class.
But because it was led by them, a lot of it had to do with the issues pertaining mostly to them.
Yeah, inheritance, things
like
that.
Yeah. Which is great. It was a start. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it would have been great if we could have started with more, you know, intersectionality.
Well, you know what's actually really interesting is, When I was researching this and kind of looking at all these different sources, I found that really in the suffrage movement was completely intertwined with the abolitionist movement. And actually, in the beginning, white women, that's really kind of like where they found their voice politically.
And I was actually gonna mention that because, so I gave Keegan this book like a month ago, and I hope
I
she
have
finds
no
the time.
Time.
I understand it, but like it's so, I wish I could just like transfer my knowledge of this book to you because it's so like it completely like, oh, one of
I'll get it on
books.
Audible. Audible sponsor us, please.
Do it.
So I can have it for free.
But the book is called The Invention of Wings by Sue Monk Kidd, and it's about the Grimke sisters. Mostly, it's about Sarah Grimke,
mm-hmm,
and it's about this girl. I think it's technically historical fiction because I don't think they have that, like, they're not going to call it nonfiction because they don't have, like, diaries and things like that of
right,
exactly what happened. But basically, Sarah Grimke was the daughter of, like, a very powerful lawyer, and when she was little, she would like sneak into his office and like read his books and stuff and said, "I want to be a lawyer." And basically, as soon as like he said that, he was like, "Haha, funny, no, you're not." And for her like 11th birthday or something, she was given a slave as a present.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is split between Sarah's point of view and her slave girl point of view, and she talks about being dressed up like a present with a bow and all this stuff, and basically Sarah wrote a legal document to her father and mother saying like, "Thank you for the gift, but no thank you," basically, and the next morning it was like ripped up by her bedroom door.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of about her, you know, teaching this girl to read and like about the differences in their lives and also how they came together through the abolitionist and feminist movements and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, it's such a good book. I didn't really know anything about first wave feminism when I read it, and that was such an amazing book for me to read, even if a lot of it was fictitious. Like, the story was so good.
Right. Well, and the story comes from something, and actually the Grimke sisters were prominent figures.
Yeah, they were very prominent, and a lot of it also, you know, they were Quakers. Sarah kind of converted to being a Quaker.
Yeah, they must have converted, right? Yeah, because Quakers did not have slaves.
No, no, no. She converted because they did not agree with that lifestyle mm-hmm. whatsoever. So she had converted and became very powerful in that world. She was very close with Lucretia Mott, who is also a Quaker and an abolitionist, a women's rights activist, social reformer. And they became really good friends, and Lucretia Mott was, like, one of her, like, mentors. And
yeah, Lucretia Mott kicks ass. Like, she comes up over and over again.
Watch, like, look at her picture. She's so severe.
No, I've seen her. Yeah, yeah. Like, she means business.
She means fucking business. But yeah, I would still want her to, like, hug me.
I bet you she was really warm and soft inside.
I bet. But she was able to turn that on and be a force to be reckoned with, you know? But it's great. Like, if you want to read a book pertaining to any of this information, like, that's really great. But there was a lot of religion and abolitionist background, anti-slavery background too.
Yeah, part of what makes the first wave so difficult to talk about is because there are so many different aspects to the people who began it.
Yes.
But I found it so interesting that the abolitionist movement is really what gave women legs. Like, they were like, okay, this is how you do it. Because they were there with a lot of other, like, men who were political figures who were kind of like, this is how you organize and agitate for change. Like, this is what you do. This is how you, you know, so they learned how to write and publicly organize.
Yeah.
And the Anti-American Slavery Society was led by William Lloyd Garrison, who encouraged the participation of women within the movement. People within the movement began to call themselves Garrisonians, and one of these Garrisonians was Lucretia Mott.
Yep.
And she believed that women should be able to gain equal access to gainful employment, equality within marriage and family. They believed in married women's rights to property, wages, and custody over their own body and their children.
Yep.
And
she was also very big into, Christian charity, like, putting, helping out the less fortunate and things like that. Mm-hmm. She was just all around a really wonderful woman.
And so she developed her own group called the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society,
mm-hmm.
and it was racially integrated and focused really heavily on the sexual abuse of slave women,
mm-hmm.
which was not only revolutionary at the time because of the way people looked at Black women in general, but also it's so sad because you see this movement coming out of the abolitionist movement, this women's movement, and you see how it could have been so intersectional from mm-hmm. the start, and then see it slowly start to unravel.
But it got taken over by different types of people. I mean, something that's great about the first wave of feminism is that it employed mostly moderate activist tactics. So a lot of it was like signing petitions, lobbying, like you said, really learning from the men in their lives. They would use like hunger strikes and picketing. And so that's, you know, really kind of founded for a lot of the things that we're still doing today, which mm-hmm. I think is really great.
Yeah. Something that I found was interesting, which kind of has us jumping ahead a little bit. We're jumping ahead of this Seneca Falls convention. But it was interesting that there wasn't a ton of information, actually, about, like, American suffrage and suffragettes. But there was a lot of information about the suffragettes of the United Kingdom.
Uh-huh.
And this is jumping ahead into the beginning of the 20th century, right? So this is after Seneca Falls. This is, you know, kind of after the time of, like, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. But the suffragettes in the United Kingdom, which is actually where the term suffragette comes from, the mm-hmm. Daily Mail coined the term suffragette, and they coined it to be kind of, like, diminutive, like, mm-hmm. And then suffragettes kind of took it mm-hmm. as their own. But the English suffragettes, and I know we have some English listeners, so hi.
Apparently, London is our number 3 listener. What?
Yeah,
that's
weird.
Crazy. Above my mom, who's number 5. When you see, like, Ketchum, Idaho, that's all my mom.
But anyway, hi, London. But you think of, like, Americans tend to think of, like, English people as being, like, way more proper than we are. But
I don't tend to think that anymore.
Their suffragette movement was way more hardcore than ours was.
Yeah.
Way more hardcore.
They damaged
property, like, on purpose. They would carry little hammers around and damage property. They're the ones who started going on hunger strikes and started chaining themselves to parliament buildings.
Badass.
And they would use these chains that were made from, that were kind of adapted from things they would use in a mental asylum.
Mm.
And they would put them under their dresses because it meant that... It meant that any cop who was going to have to come and get them was not only going to have to manhandle them, but was going to have to get under their skirt to take them off.
And then be like, uh-uh.
So they were super hardcore. Like, they vandalized churches. They did all kinds of things. And our suffragette movement really didn't get that radical until... I know, who was it, Alice Paul? Yeah, Alice Paul studied in England and came back to the United States in 1910, and she was the one who introduced their suffragette tactics, or their tactics of civil disobedience.
Yeah, I'm going to say this wrong, but she organized events such as, like, the Women's Suffrage Procession and the Silent Sentinels? Sentinels?
Sentinels?
I'm going to say it wrong. I'm horrible. Yeah, that's what it is. I just can't say it. Yeah, she definitely was a little bit more... She talked a little bit more about sex and things like that a little bit, too. Not quite as much as...
she was definitely more radical.
But she... Yeah. Well, I mean, and that makes sense, because she did spend time in other places.
Yeah, she studied in England, and she also became pretty active in their suffragette movement, so that when she came back... She's American.
Yeah.
And when she came back to the States, she was just like...
able to kind of... teach us
She's
ways.
Like, this is where you guys are getting it wrong.
Yeah.
Like, look, you want change, this is how we're going to do it. Well, actually, I think that's a really good opportunity to kind of bounce back up to the 1800s, so we can kind of start to figure out where, because I know we've been talking in episodes past for a while now about intersectionality or lack thereof within this first wave.
Well, especially because we... focused on Black History Month the last few months, talking about how they were overlooked.
Happy Women's History Month.
Happy Women's History Month, guys.
To all of our listeners.
Did I also just say that we've been talking about Black History Month the last few months?
The last few months. We've been talking about 1 month. Good. We should be, actually.
We should be. Maybe it was like a good Freudian slip.
So, most people, I think, attribute that the first wave of feminism starting with that Seneca Falls Convention in 1848, but I'm actually going to even push it back a decade further up.
I dare you.
I accept your challenge. It's very, like, come at me, bro, you know what I mean? In 1938, there was an anti-slavery convention of American women in New York City, and they actually had to build their own convention hall because
no one wanted
they wanted the event to be fully integrated.
Yeah.
And people were pissed.
Yeah.
Like, racist white people were pissed. And so they built this convention hall. It was fully integrated. They had women giving lectures in front of men and women, which was kind of, like, unheard of at that time.
Yeah.
Because women lecturing men was kind of, like, a big deal. And, like, they had black and white men outside, like, arm in arm.
Yeah.
To protect the black women that were inside.
Wow. What was this called again?
It was called the Anti-Slavery Convention of American Women in 1838.
I feel like this was another thing that was talked about in my favorite book.
Probably. They were probably there.
Yeah. Yep. They showed up. Oh, no, it's Lucretia Mott. But I'm sure they were there, too. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
Getting distracted. Continue.
And just kind of a side note, that the following year after the convention hall was burned down.
Of course it was.
By racists, so that sucks.
Damn racists. I know. Why you gotta always ruin shit?
I know. Well, I mean.
I mean.
Because they suck.
And the beat goes on.
But so, to me, that was kind of like the last big thing organized by women that could be associated with women's rights.
And the abolitionist movement.
Kind of like joining together.
Yeah.
And then in July 1948, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and Lucretia Mott organized and held the Seneca Falls Convention. And this is kind of where you start to see a little bit of a shift.
Mm-hmm.
Because while all these women are abolitionists, they believe in equal rights for freeing slaves and all that, the only black person in attendance was Frederick Douglass.
Yeah.
And he was the first notable man to publicly advocate for women's suffrage, which is amazing, but they had no black women in attendance at this thing.
I feel like it's one of those things where it's like, you see it in movies all the time where, like, as you rise to power, in a way, not that they were necessarily powerful, because they were still, you know, having to really fight for their own rights, but in a way, because, you know, they were organizing this huge event and things like that, in a way, in their little circle, they were powerful. And I feel like what we see a lot of times is when people reach that point, they start to kind of forget about other people and get kind of focused on their own issues. And for me, I feel like that's the real root of non-intersectional feminism.
Mm-hmm.
It's it's a concern because things affect you. And I don't know if it was a purposeful thing. You know, we can't ask these people what their deal was, but if I were to guess, what happened is that they got caught up, or maybe they had people surrounding them that were like, if you really want to make a difference, you're going to have to not invite these people. You know what I mean? Like,
and it might not have even at this stage been a really conscious thing, because right. I think at this stage they were still really advocating for the white rights.
But that's
of
the thing
black
is
and
that
white,
you can be, but you can be in your head, you can be like, yes, I'm still fighting for these people, but then kind of be caught up at the same time, mm-hmm. and not realize that you're making those mistakes. Like, if I, you know, it could have very well not have been like, we're purposefully gonna like
exclude
these people, mm-hmm. but it could have been more of like a subconscious thing as well.
Well, I mean, and at this stage, I'm kind of like, okay, like I'm like, okay, it'd be better. Of course, there were black abolitionists who existed at this time who you could have, should have invited. I mean,
or that
we
you
talked
already
about,
had kind of like relationships.
Yeah, we
with
talked
too.
About Sojourner Truth. She
yeah.
she could have, should have been there.
Should have
arguably,
been there, definitely.
You know. But at this point, I kind of understand it a little bit. Well, I mean, I do and I don't. But
yeah,
I
still think it's kind of fucky. But
it is shitty. I understand it a little bit more the further on we get, which we'll talk about.
Mm-hmm. Can I mention really quick?
Absolutely.
That I. The first time I ever remember hearing and really listening to the Declaration of Sentiments was in college,
mm-hmm.
and I love that
yeah.
piece
yeah.
so much. Like, when I was in college, like, the first day, so we had a history class that was based on more of, like, the culture history a mm-hmm. little bit. So we had a whole week on feminism, basically, where we had to kind of like jam pack everything in there. And I just remember everybody in class just like turning and staring at me when they said that. And I was just like, this is great. But at the same time, like, shut the fuck up.
Now you know how I feel during Black History Month.
Yeah. Right? It's so annoying.
When you go to an all white school and then they're like, we're going to talk about Black History Month, and everyone's like,
anytime they talk about a black person, they turn to you and they're like,
and
give
like,
me.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't know them personally.
Well, I just remember like, oh, and there was this kid in my class who I loved dearly, but he was such an idiot when he was younger. And, like, he talked about my teacher talked about the waves of feminism, how it kind of went up and down. And he's like the girls' boobies, they go up and down. And I was like, this is what I yeah, I was like, stop. Oh, it made me so mad. It made me so, so mad. But I just remember,
this is why I can never go back to school. Like, I literally can't, because I'm just like, I have zero patience for that dumb shit that,
no.
like,
if I were to ever go back to school, I think I would need to take, like, online classes. I wouldn't want to deal with other people.
I'd have to be with other people my age who've outgrown that.
Yeah.
You know what
no,
I mean?
No, I agree. But something great, I mean, I got a lot of really great stuff out of it. It was the first history class that I ever was in where I, like, really wanted to learn more, because when I was younger, I was like, this is boring. I don't want to listen to all this stuff. But I just remember hearing the Declaration of Sentiments, and the whole time my head,
want to put your fist up?
Like, the guy at the end of the Breakfast Club.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's like, yes!
Yeah.
And just, like, because it's so similar to the Declaration of Independence, and then they're just like, we're just gonna twist the knife and say, fuck you a little bit, and we're gonna make it for us.
Yeah, so basically, they wrote, we hold these truths to be said self-evident, that all men and women
yep.
are created equal. So that was kind of like the gist of the Declaration
yeah,
of Sentiments.
Yeah, they just took the words from the Declaration of Independence and were able to kind of twist it to be this badass feminist piece. And it was written by Lucretia Mott. And,
Elizabeth Cady Stanton, I think.
Yeah.
So it was just, honestly, this convention was super, super powerful, and I wish that people of color could have or
I mean,
would have
how
been
much more
in attendance.
Wonderful would it have been if it had been more of a joint event?
Yeah.
Because for me, while you're saying in a way you understand. Like, for me, it's like, because we know what happens, it's kind of like, okay, you're setting it up for, like, years and years and years of segregation and feminism.
Well, to be honest, I understand it less here than I do later on. So
right.
We'll get to that. I do understand it less here.
But you know that that's where it starts. You know what I mean?
Yes. This is because, you know, hindsight is 20/20. And, like, this is definitely where we can start to see, like, ooh, we should have been more inclusive from the start.
Yes.
And I think that they kind of thought they were filling their black person quota by having Frederick Douglass there to kind of, like, represent the black delegation. You know what I mean? But
because, you know, one person really does represent all, you know?
And look, Frederick Douglass, amazing man.
Totally, but you know, he can't speak for...
But he's a man.
He's a man, and he can't speak for the general population, just as when you're in school growing up and they talk about Black History Month and they're all turning towards you.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's the same kind of thing. One person can't be the representative of
And he can't be the representative of Black women, like,
no,
at all, because
no,
he's not a Black woman.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's where we really start to see this, is that Black women, time and time again, or women of color, time and time again, are getting left behind in these conversations.
Definitely.
But
I'm trying to say definitely more than totally. Less.
I know, because I say absolutely a
absolutely
lot.
Absolutely.
But I came into this today trying to find a balance. Whenever I knew we were going to do this episode, I was like, Keegan, don't just talk about the lack of intersectionality the entire time. Try to focus on the positive. Because, I mean, what they did was still really incredible.
It was, but the thing is that there are positives and negatives to pretty much every
Everything.
Movement in
yeah,
history.
That's
so
right.
While there, we are not taking away any bit of positive thing that comes from this, it would be naive of us to not mention the things that were problematic.
Absolutely. And we will continue to
of
throughout
course,
this episode.
Of course.
But so they brought together 200 men and 40 women, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, I know. Less than 50%
Okay, good job, guys.
I see. 40 men. Yeah. That's all you could get to show up. Okay, fine. That's cool.
Okay,
whatever.
Okay, just fine.
The delegates believed women to be citizens, not limited in any way to their roles as wives and mothers. They rejected Victorian domesticity and its separation of women and men into private and public spheres, respectively. Later on in the movement, white feminists in the first wave started to get really upset because they were there before the civil rights movement. They were kind of pushing for abolition and that sort of thing. Then they started building up steam with the Seneca Falls Convention to get suffrage going. And then the Civil War happened, and they were like, okay, cool. We'll back off, right? we'll chill
while
the Civil
man.
War happens, right?
We'll chill. We'll eat some chips.
Yeah, we'll
binge
our,
watch some Netflix.
Right.
We'll chill.
We'll wait
it's
our
good.
Turn. We'll catch some Broad City. We'll catch it on the other side of this, right?
Broad City.
And then they got on the other side of it, and they were like, okay, so about women's suffrage. Hey,
yeah,
by the way, we still want our right to vote. And then they were like, chill your shit.
Yeah.
We have to pass, like, the 14th and 15th Amendments allowing black men the right to vote.
Yeah.
And it was at this point where this is despicable and really disheartening and hurts me as a feminist who really always looked up to Susan B. Anthony and love, and I do love her and respect the things she did for the movement.
But know what you're gonna say.
On the other side of it, I understand that she was completely fed up with this.
Yeah.
And she said, I will cut off this arm of mine before I will ever work or demand the ballot for the Negro and not women. So she was basically saying, I'm not here to help black men. Like, I'm not going to help one more man, black or white, get the right to vote.
Right. Which, in a way, when she's saying is, she's being passionate about what she believes in, but in her saying that, she's disregarding an entire group of people that she, if they were to band together, would be the most powerful group of people.
Well, and regardless of just disregarding black people, this is where it gets so frustrating, because it's just like, and this is what we talked about when we talked about Sojourner Truth, where it's like, okay, but there are black women.
Yes.
Like, you have...
She's completely disregarding
it. Yeah, your white men, the men of your race, have the right to vote. none of these people over here have the right to vote at all. Is it fucked up that that white women don't have the right to vote? Yes, it is. But by saying that you won't help work to try and raise up black people mean that you are putting black women at the very bottom
of the totem pole. And you are doing to other people exactly what you feel is unfair this week.
Right. And I understand her frustration. Like, yes. I get it, because it's just like, you feel like you've helped already. Like, you feel like you've done your work.
Obviously, it's not finished yet.
Right.
She shouldn't be giving up yet. And you said this was what, like in the 1840s-ish?
Well, this would have been after the Civil War. So the Civil War was in the 1860s. So this is probably 1870s or 1880s, you know?
Yeah. I've got like a little timeline of first wave accomplishments, and if we're going to kind of catch up a minute to this time, I'm going to go through 1833 through 1860. I'm going to tell you some things that happened.
Please.
1833, the first co-educational university in the U.S., which was Oberlin.
Oh, wow.
Don't know where it is. Didn't look it up. I'll do that another time. Like you said, 1848, Seneca Falls Convention. 1854, Florence Nightingale, my girl. I think I talked about in another episode how I dressed up as her for a school project. Yeah, my girl. She establishes the female nurses adjuncts to the military, which is awesome. 1851, Keegan's girl, Sojourner Truth, delivers a Ain't I a Woman speech at Ohio's Women's Rights Convention, bringing race into the conversation. In 1855, the first co-ed public or state school was the University of Iowa, which to me is crazy because that's the middle of fucking nowhere.
Isn't that funny? Just cornfields and one...
one co-ed university. State school. But, you know, awesome. That's a great thing for them to be known for, and that makes me like Iowa a little more. 1860, New York's revised Married Women's Property Act.
Oh, yeah,
which allows women shared ownership of children and say in their wills and wages, allows women to inherit property. That went through in 1860.
Yeah.
And then literally, unless I... Because I kind of just did, like, my little highlights from this. From this website that I had that was, oh God, what was it called? I sent it to you.
Gender Press. I couldn't get it to work for me.
Oh, see, maybe because I found it just through Google, and like, I think it was on like a few pages in.
Oh, okay.
It was a really great website though. And maybe I just didn't write anything down, but I just realized it goes from 1860 to 1892.
Well, I think, I mean, there was definitely stuff between that, but I think, you know, the Civil War really took... over. And, you know, people didn't talk about much else.
The next thing I have written down is 1892, investigative African-American journalist and activist Ida B. Wells, a freed slave, publishes and lectures from her book, Southern Horrors, Lynch Law in Its Phases.
Ida B. Wells, we could have an entire episode talking about Ida B. Wells.
I'm sure we could, which we probably will at some time.
We should.
I mean, I think like maybe once a month doing our little like feminist book reports would be cool. More wine, please.
Yes.
Pour it into the microphone.
We are drinking liberated wine once again. I bought it because not only is it good, but I feel like it's appropriate for these kinds of conversations.
If you're going to drink wine, have it be liberated wine.
That's exactly right.
This is our liberation juice. Moms have mom juice. We have liberation juice.
Cheers,
my dear. Whoa, that was loud in my ear.
So, yeah. And unfortunately, our lovely ladies, our lovely complicated ladies, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they did not manage to live to see the vote. But actually, something that I wanted to mention, I should have said this before.
Well, I mean, if we're going to talk about Elizabeth Cady Stanton a little bit, she also addressed various issues that expanded beyond the right to vote, such as parental custody rights, property rights, employment and income rights, divorce, economic health for family, and birth control, which was
kind of radical
way before her time. Mm-hmm. She was an outspoken supporter of the temperance movement, which I
guess. What's interesting is this is what I meant when I said that. The feminist movement, the first wave feminist movement, is all over the map.
It is.
Because people, feminists who were involved in the temperance movement were a big reason why women eventually ended up getting the right to vote, which the temperance movement was basically, they were advocates of prohibition.
Yeah.
So, I mean, among other
things.
And there was
quite a few women who were advocates for prohibition.
Right. And it was the temperance movement wasn't just advocacy for prohibition.
Wasn't it something to do with religion with it as well? Or am I thinking something
else?
Yes,
it did. It was involved. I don't know everything that it was involved in, but I do know that it being involved with, you know, advocating for prohibition is what helped allow women to get the right to vote, because they were able to use that as kind of like a bargaining chip, where they were like, look, we have all of these women who would be willing to vote for prohibition if you can help us push this amendment through, you know? But I wanted to jump back up before we move on from Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and the people of this time.
Yep.
Is in Women, Race, and Class by Angela Davis, who I love. You know I love Angela Davis. Mm-hmm. She recounts how at the end of the 19th century, so the end of the 1800s, the women's suffrage movement effectively sold out to monopoly capitalists mm-hmm. and white supremacy when they accepted to help the help of powerful Democrats who used the prospect of the educated, genteel white woman canceling out the ignorant Negro vote.
Yes.
So, and this is in, like, Chapter 7 of Women, Race, and Class. So, they used that to push the idea of women's suffrage, which is really, again, really sad.
Yeah.
It makes sense politically. Like, they saw this, they saw an, like, they're smart women, like, they saw an opening and they took it, as far as it being, like...
It's like political figures today taking money from the NRA.
Ooh, burn. Ooh. But, yeah, I mean, really, it's that kind of political chess move of saying, like, look, we can offer you something that you want. You're terrified of Negro men... Black men getting the right to vote mm-hmm. and everything that that entails. And we could cancel that out because we're of the same class as you and we're white.
Yeah.
And if you give us the right to vote, we'll vote more along the party lines.
Yeah. You. They kind of had to make a deal with the devil in a way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it didn't work, but they did do that. Hey there, listeners. Keegan here. Did you know that our girl Madigan is coming out with her own adult coloring book? The Inappropriate Coloring Book is chock full of feminist slogans, curse words, and potty humor, all framed by Madigan's awesome hand-drawn designs. The full book isn't available just yet, but if you'd like to purchase individual prints or just check out what's to come, follow the Instagram page at The Inappropriate Coloring Book or check out her Etsy page at etsy.com/shop/bemoreinappropriate.
Okay, so Keegan, from here, I think let's go down the timeline a little bit and let's just chit-chat about these things that I have written here.
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, cool. So, as I said, it went from 1860 to 1892 here, and we already talked a little bit about, well, we mentioned briefly Ida B. Wells and
her badassness. We filled the gap a little bit.
After that, I have 1913, which is another big gap. Like I said, I'm sure I'm missing a million things.
Well, we already covered in 1910 is when... What's her face came back from England.
You're gonna be my date holder.
I can't remember dates. Alice Paul
for the life of me.
When Alice Paul came back in 1910, so we've got that a little bit covered. So she came back and kind of kickstarted, I think what a lot of people think of as like our what we think of now as like the votes for women and the sashes and the big hats and the white outfits.
And speaking of Alice Paul, in 1913 was when she had organized the infamous March of Women's Suffrage in Washington, which is often considered the moment when the fight for women's rights was desegregated. What are you thinking about that?
I don't know that I
wouldn't say it was desegregated.
I was going to say, I don't know that I agree with that, actually. I think, I'm going to be real honest with listeners right now that we're getting into the parts of the first wave that I'm not as well versed in, but it is my understanding that during those marches, they still wanted white women to be in the front, followed mm-hmm. by white men, followed by any black men who wanted to march, followed by black women.
Yes.
So while they were able to participate, which I think is what she means when they say desegregated, as in they allowed people of color to march with them, It wasn't
like a welcoming.
They were still having to march in the back.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
But I think that is the same. I could be totally wrong. We're going to have people emailing us.
That's fine. Teach us.
But I think that might be the same march. I know it was Alice Paul who introduced, because again, she was using tactics that they used in England, and she and some others chained themselves to the Capitol.
Okay. I mean, probably, because it was in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't look into it in depth. I have it just written here in my handy-dandy timeline. In 1915, American Medical Association begins to admit women, which is great. There were a lot more
female lady doctors.
Nurses. And I don't know about doctors, exactly.
We can dream.
We can dream. My new hero that I want to learn more about is Margaret Sanger. Question. How do you say the thing that you put your clothes on in the closet?
A hanger?
You pronounce the G too.
Do you say hanger?
Hanger. No, there's no G in it.
There is a G. It's a hanger.
It is not. No, but you don't pronounce it. If you look, okay. So, sorry to get into this, but this is important to me. So, when I was in college again, we had a speech teacher, and we learned IPA.
Right.
And in IPA, the ng sound is like an N connected to a G.
Right.
It's an ng. Your tongue is hanger. In the back. Hanger. You don't pronounce the hard G. And I asked my teacher, who is like a Shakespeare like okay. lady. I was like,
Which teacher did you have?
I don't think you ever had her. She was from Minnesota, so maybe she was impartial to me.
Okay.
But, okay, I had a friend from Texas, and Chris, who's from New York, they both say hanger and singer, and it pisses me up. But that's not what you say. That's not the general American way. Singer. I'm a singer. I'm a hanger.
Hanger.
It's not
I say the G in hanger. I don't
hanger
say it.
Hanger is when you're hangry.
Okay. I
sorry,
disagree.
Because, well, I was trying to figure out if it was Margaret Sanger or Sanger, which for the name sounds better as Sanger.
Margaret Sanger.
God, this is going to cause a rift in our friendship.
I think it might.
Feel it. Keegan, let's
listeners,
fight about
what
it.
Are you? What do you do?
What do you
say?
Do? Because I am firm on hanger.
We're going to make a poll on our Instagram
Chris,
story.
Chris, this is his, this is how he thinks I sound when I say it. He's like, hanger. Hair. I'm like, I don't sound like a donkey.
No. Hanger. I don't know.
Hanger. Because you put the N and the G together
to
make
it. Regional. I think it's regional.
That pisses me off.
You seem
very. We're learning general American.
I think.
They made me get rid of my E's.
Yeah, let me tell
you. They made me say my last name different.
Minnesota is definitely not general
American.
Well, yeah,
I am not seeing Minnesota is generally American. I'm giving the worst Minnesota accent ever. But, like, that's what I'm saying is I used to say my last name was Haggerty instead of Haggerty. And I say Haggerty
now. Yeah, you say a hard A.
Where I used to say, or, like, give me the bag over there.
Yeah.
I said big, but I couldn't even hear that it was wrong.
So you can't trust a speech teacher from Minnesota.
No, but she lived there when she was younger. But like me, she moved to LA when she was young, and she's a speech teacher. She learned general American dialect to teach us.
I don't know.
But I have to say, a lot of people in my life are on your side, which is why I needed at least my speech teacher to be on my side.
Hey, here's what we're gonna do. We'll ask Anthony when he gets home because Anthony is from Ohio, and they also do that hard A thing. So maybe you guys have more in common, like speech-wise.
I don't think that's it, though. I think it's just that, generally speaking, that's what most people do. I think
I say singer.
Yeah, but I don't say singer.
But I say hanger.
God, that's so obnoxious.
Anyways, I'm gonna have to cut some of this down. But
Margaret Sanger. She opened the first birth control clinic in the U.S., which led to her arrest, and eventually opened the first clinic with all female staff and the first clinic in Harlem staffed entirely by African Americans, which
right.
is cool. And what she did eventually in 1921, she had coined the term birth control and formed the American Birth Control League, which was later called Planned Parenthood. And she got a lot of hate. Because they, even at that time, were saying that it was a place for abortions to be happening. Mm-hmm. And this is something that is still, we need to definitely have a birth control episode. Absolutely. Because this is something that's still so misunderstood. Like, there was a thing going around for a while that was saying, if you call Planned Parenthood, they'll say, oh no, we only do abortions here, which is bullshit.
For years before I had health insurance, I went to Planned Parenthood.
That's what I do. I go to Planned Parenthood. I have their special little green card because
I did too, because I was poor. Yeah.
And so does Chris. Chris mm-hmm. goes and he gets a lot of his needs mm-hmm. taken care of.
I think people truly don't understand what Planned Parenthood does for women.
And honestly, and that's something that I'm such a huge advocate because it has literally saved my life. They were there and gave me an ultrasound and told me that I had cysts on my ovaries. They were mm-hmm. there to help me. I'm very difficult when it comes to birth control. My body doesn't take it very well, and they were there for me in order to help me kind of get through that part of my life.
We definitely need to have a birth control episode because yes. I think people also don't understand, because I know you and I both have issues with our
lady parts.
Yes. I was trying to think of the right way to say that.
Yeah.
But we both do, and birth control is so much, I wish I was on it right now, to be honest. Yeah. Because it is so much more than just preventing you from having children. It's also medically necessary for some women. Right. Very, very helpful.
I think a lot of people are starting to see that, but there's also still that whole thing about Planned Parenthood being officially for abortions, which is interesting because Planned Parenthood didn't even provide abortions until 1970, which was after Sanger mm-hmm. died. Which is crazy, but yet she got a lot of shit for it, and she probably, because part of her wanting to open it was because she wanted to eventually prevent back alley abortions, which mm-hmm. were so prominent in that time.
Well, okay. I feel like I'm always this person.
What?
Because I actually do admire Margaret Sanger, and it's something that
It's okay. Bring her down for me. It's fine.
No. I do admire her, and I think that I don't want to diminish anything that she did or stood for. She also was, and let me kind of expound on this before jumping to conclusions by this word, because this word is very triggering, but she was a proponent of eugenics. Not in the way of, she swears that her eugenics were not racially motivated.
Okay.
That it was, she believed in, let me see if I can find what it was called. Sorry, hold on.
So kind of like master race shit?
No, well, that's exactly it. She didn't believe in like racially motivated eugenics. Like, it wasn't by race. It was more by ability and intelligence.
Oh.
So she actually was a proponent for, and this is where I differ from her the most,
uh-huh.
was that she was a proponent for sterilization of people who were mentally handicapped.
Nope.
She didn't think that they should procreate. She also didn't think that poor and uneducated people should be procreating in great numbers.
Yeah.
Which is not inherently racist. And she said,
at the time.
Well, and she was very much adamant that she was not racist. And
but when you're so adamant, it's like, okay, why are you trying so hard?
Yeah, I mean, and she donated to the American Council Against Nazi Propaganda. Like, she didn't believe in that kind of master race bullshit.
But when we're touching on disability, though, also, I think in that time, there was so much lack of knowledge on, like, mentally handicapped and disabled people.
Well,
not saying that what she is saying is right or correct at all. But what she's saying, whether she believes it or not, does touch on race and ableism.
Well, it touches on ableism, absolutely, from that perspective of mentally handicapped people. But on the other end, when you're talking about uneducated and poor people,
At the time,
how many, you might not be racist, but how many uneducated poor people are people of color?
Yeah, because they weren't given the opportunity.
They didn't have access to education or ways to get, you know, fair income. So you are talking about communities of color and wanting to limit their ability to procreate.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times do we hear progressives say things like that, where it's just like, hey, smart, educated people need to be, we're the ones who need to be having the kids, and these, like, poor hillbillies need to be the ones who stop having kids.
Because,
which is what she's saying, but you can't, you also just can't do that. You can't limit people's rights to have as many kids as they want, you know?
But this is the thing, and to me, as wrong as it is that she's saying that, I think that it's good to acknowledge the fact that people in general are flawed.
Uh-huh.
That we Absolutely. Can praise people for doing the good things that Absolutely. They did, and we can also at the same time acknowledge the things that they'd done wrong.
Absolutely. And that's what I'm trying to do here. And it's hard to strike
but that's,
that balance.
And
that's, you know what I mean?
But that's exactly what I just got from what you said.
Good.
So that's why I wanted to say it. So no, and I think it's great. So Margaret Sanger, we applaud you for everything that you've done.
And
for,
God for bless and, you for Planned Parenthood because
right?
again
saved my life.
You and I both. Like we you and I both were real poor
yep.
college students who didn't have health insurance yeah. for years. And yeah. without Planned Parenthood, I mean,
I would have struggled hardcore. And so would have Chris. Like they do a lot of like, kind of like physical examinations and things mm-hmm. like that. And,
it's so much more than birth control and abortion.
That's the thing. And I think it's seen as such a female issue, too, when it's just a person issue.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it needs to be broadened and understood better that it's a quality health care for people who really need help.
Yeah.
Okay, so we just touched on, like, 1916 and, like, 1921. Marie Stopes, in 1918, published Married Love.
Ooh.
Which became more popular than works by both Einstein and Freud at the time. And it argues the importance of women's sexual desire.
Ooh, which right? was incredibly taboo at the time. People were like, I'm sorry, what? Women what? Could enjoy having sex?
Yeah.
Isn't that's just something still, we make them do?
That's still something that is, like, amazing to some people. Have you watched the Netflix show Big Mouth?
No.
Watch it.
I know.
It's so good.
Everyone tells me to watch that
it's
show.
It's so good. They talk about it. There's an episode where, like, they're reading, like, the girls are all obsessed with this, like, romance novel. And this boy, one of the main characters, is trying to figure out, like, why, like, if they don't have sex in the book, like, what's, like, turning these girls on? And the girl's like, you know, girls want to have sex just as much as boys do. And it's a cartoon, so it's just, like, it shows his mind being blown. He's like, what? She's like, yeah, we just don't talk about it all the time. And so, I mean, it's still something that we definitely talk about today that, you know, women mm-hmm. aren't disinterested in sex, which, I mean, there are some women who are disinterested in sex.
There are some men who are disinterested in sex. Yeah.
Jinx, you owe me a soda. so that is amazing to me, and I would love to at least read parts of that book. In 1920, the 19th Amendment passed in the U.S., which gave women the right to vote, which
yes.
was great.
Yeah.
There's that. And I have the problematic shit at the bottom, but it's pretty much everything that we've already talked
about.
Yeah,
we have already covered the problematic shit pretty thoroughly throughout.
Pretty thoroughly. Well, let's see if there's anybody else here that we haven't really talked about that I have written down here. Let's talk a little bit about Dr. Elizabeth Blackwell. She was a British physician, notable as the first woman to receive a medical degree in the United States and the first woman on the medical register of General Medical Council.
Mm-hmm.
She was the first woman to graduate from a medical school, a pioneer in promoting the education of women in medicine in the United States, and a social and moral reformer in both the United States and the United Kingdom.
Hell yeah.
So that's Dr. Elizabeth Blackwell. Let's move on to Jane Addams a little bit. Jane Addams, known as the mother of social work, what I have written here says, was a pioneer American settlement activist, reformer, social worker, public...
Was a pioneer, American
That's what activist. I was missing. That's what I was missing. There was a lot of weird copy-pasting.
No, I get
on.
It.
And me also trying to add my own, like, grammar in there.
I do the same thing, and then I end up, like, screwing myself up.
It's great. Which I just did. Activist, reformer, social worker, public philosopher, sociologist, author, and leader in women's suffrage and world peace. One of the most prominent reformers of the progressive era. She helped America address and focus on issues that were of concern to mothers, such as needs of children and local public health, which is great. In her essay, Utilization of Women in City Government, Jane Addams noted the connection between the workings of government and the household. So she kind of was able to put things in a way for men who worked in the government and higher power.
Kind of bridge that gap.
In order to kind of understand what their day-to-day lives are in order to make them understand a little bit more of their worth.
Mm-hmm.
In 1931, she became the first American woman to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
Fucking yeah.
Mm-hmm. And is recognized as the founder of social work profession in the United States. We've already talked a little bit about the Grimke sisters. What I have written here specifically is that they were the first American female advocates of abolition and women's rights. They grew up in a slaveholding family in southern United States, but moved to the North in the 1820s. They became more deeply involved in the abolitionist movement, traveling on its lecture circuit and recounting their firsthand experiences with slavery on their family's plantation. I'm, again, going to throw out that everybody should read the Sue Monk Kidd book, The Invention of Wings. It's fantastic. And they were really ridiculed for their abolitionist activity as well. They were definitely outsiders. They later in life learned that their late brother had 3 mixed-race sons, and they helped those boys get the education they needed.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So they're people that really did hold on to their abolitionist beliefs and were very unpopular. They went from being unknown to being very popular in the feminist movement to kind of being outcast,
losing their popularity,
but still always kind of maintaining their beliefs. And that's something
I think that's in, like, I'm so impressed by that, because even for me nowadays, living in the 21st century, I'm still such, I mean, we've talked about it the last couple of weeks, I'm still such a baby when it comes to, like, going against, like, you know, beliefs about other people or really rocking the boat or wanting to, like, do any of that. And so it takes somebody of very, very strong moral character to be able to split from your family in that way.
Right. But what's beautiful about what she did is that, you know, she had her sister. Mm-hmm. You know, the two sisters really had each other's backs. And
which does make it so much easier when you have someone else who's there.
It does. And they, and for Sarah, because I read the book that's mostly about her, she just never really understood why the separation between the races really had to be a thing, why they had to be treated different. These girls
were the same. Yeah, but that's incredible.
They were the same age. They loved each other. They had a connection. And it does show, you know, their differences and how one was definitely more privileged than the other. And
her parents probably unwittingly created this person. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Because you gave her access to, you let her develop a relationship with another person of another race, and you humanized that person.
Exactly. Well, they were trying to dehumanize them, and
it just didn't work. It backfired.
So, seriously, learn more about the Grimke sisters. I freaking love them. Their pictures,
we'll have an episode on them sometime.
Are scary to me. They look very severe and frightening.
No, I like that you, like, said no offense, like they're going to listen to this podcast. You're like, no offense, Sarah, you guys. But Jesus Christ.
But you look scary as fuck. I just, like, I picture in my head is this, like, kind of blonde, cute, whatever. And then I see your pictures and I'm like, ah!
You're like, Jesus Christ.
You scary, girl. Moving on. Jane Hunt, another American Quaker. She was
Quakers,
one of,
man. Can Quakers. We have a whole episode on Quakers?
Let's do it.
They were just crushing shit.
Crushing shit. I just think of oatmeal. we've talked a lot about Susan B. Anthony, and she's someone that I knew about generally, but I don't know.
She,
like,
was on
the
that dollar.
Detail. Well, I was gonna say she was the first actual. Did I just write? She became the first actual woman to be depicted on the U.S. coinage. That's totally a copy paste. But
coinage is a word.
No. Actual woman is what I'm laughing
at.
Oh,
the first actual.
She's
woman.
She's an actual woman.
Yeah, what does that mean?
I don't know, but it makes me laugh. She was the first actual woman to be depicted on U.S. coinage, with her portrait appeared on the $1979 dollar coin.
Did you ever have one of those?
I think I might have.
I totally did. They were awesome.
Let's see.
You know that Harriet Tubman's going to be on the 20, right?
Yes, and I'm very excited about it. When is that happening?
2026.
Now? Thanks.
2026. Oh. We have to wait.
Man.
I know.
Well, Susan B. Anthony was definitely harshly ridiculed because she was, they claimed that she was trying to destroy the institution of marriage. She's probably somebody in this day and age that probably would be a very big advocate for gay marriage, I feel like, as well, if she was around during this time, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Now that other people have their rights, I think so.
Right.
Yeah.
No, but yeah. But yeah.
no, but yeah. But yeah.
Shut up. Let's see. 1878. I'm reading this backwards, which is fun.
No, you're fine.
1878, Anthony and Stanton arranged for Congress to be presented with an amendment giving women the right to vote. And people, what I read here is apparently people later called it the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, which I've never heard of before.
Can we address how fucking pissed off you'd be if you were Elizabeth Cady Stanton and you were around right now?
Yeah, yeah.
Because, like,
I've never heard of her. I've never heard of her.
That's exactly right. Yeah. It's like, and man, props to Susan B. Anthony, of course, but it's like, man, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was right there next to you this entire time and did just as much shit.
Yeah.
And didn't get nearly as much recognition for
it. Which you knew, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's keep talking about Katie Stranton. Let me read her bullet-pointed list of badass shit she did. As we said before, she was one of the authors for the Declaration of Sentiments. Go read it. It's great. She was the president of the National Women's Suffrage Association in, I can never say that word right, in 1892, until 1900. Before Stanton, narrowed her political focus almost exclusively to women's rights, she was an active abolitionist with her husband, Henry Brewster Stanton, co-founder of the Republican Party.
Well, but, okay. But you also have to, well, you have to remember at this time,
right,
the parties were switched.
Yes. No, that's true. It's true.
Yeah.
But I'm more so sighing about the wording of, it's very interesting wording for it being a feminist website that I got this from, where it's like, before she narrowed her interest to the feminist movement, she was involved in the abolitionists.
Well, I think that they say that because both her and Susan B. Anthony, as we stated earlier, kind of really pulled away from...
No, I know, and that's what I'm saying. It's kind of... But the fact that they're saying that they narrowed it to, like, the women's rights movement is kind of, to me, a bit of an oxymoron, because it's, like...
It's still so broad.
It's very broad, and it's also because it's, like, to me, they should be one and the same. You know what I mean? It's just, it's a side
moment. It should be, but it, you know, as we said, it wasn't at this time.
Yep.
This is before intersectionality.
Yep. And again, she wrote the Women's Bible, which, I mean, that's cool.
No, she's a badass lady, and we should know more about her for sure.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these women that I mean, I just touched on very few. These are ones that I just read a little bit about. I put down Sojourner Truth as well, and if you want to hear more about her, listen to, not the last episode, but the episode before that, right?
Listen to...
The Trailblazers episode, right?
Our Trailblazers episode.
Yeah, listen to that, and you'll learn more about Sojourner Truth, because without her... A lot of this stuff wouldn't be happening. We wouldn't have a lot of the most wonderful feminist moments of all time.
Absolutely. So I kind of just wanted to, because we touched on and then kind of passed over the 19th Amendment, mm-hmm. and really, that's what all of this was kind of leading up to.
Yes.
So I do want to get into what that is.
Let's
just
go for
a
it.
Little bit before we kind of like start drawing wrapping it up. So for those who don't know, the 19th Amendment in 1920 allowed women the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And it prohibited states and federal government from denying the right to vote to citizens of the United States on the basis of sex. So by this time, there were already states that were allowing women the right to vote. Mm-hmm. But it was basically, it's the same thing that happened with gay marriage, if you want to put it into those terms, where state by state, right. you could kind of make a decision. But
this was when it
federally,
was kind of, yes,
it was
federal
not,
law.
It was not federal law. So on August 18th, 1920 is when that happened. It effectively overruled Minor versus Happersett, in which a unanimous Supreme Court ruled that the 14th Amendment did not give women the right to vote. And the 14th Amendment was one of the Reconstruction Amendments that happened after the Civil War. So it happened on July 9th, 1868.
That's my birthday!
On Madigan's birthday.
Oh my god, that's my birthday!
And I think I just said 1968, which is incredible. 18.
Guys, I was born in 1968. That's crazy.
Madigan is actually 49 years old.
I would be older than that, wouldn't I?
No, my mom was born in 1967, and she's 50.
There you go.
That's the only way I can do math, is if I put it in reference to, like,
because for me, like, I was like, oh, my mom graduated high school in 69, but that doesn't help me.
So
sorry.
No, that's okay. So if we're working through the amendments, the 13th Amendment was the emancipation, right?
Yep.
Of, you know, freeing Black people,
yes.
freeing slaves. Then the 14th Amendment addresses citizenship rights and equal protection of the laws, and was proposed in a response to issues related to former slaves following the American mm-hmm. Civil War. So the...
Yes.
So this amendment also is interesting because people like Katie Stanton and Susan B. Anthony tried to use this amendment to say that we are natural citizens of this country and we should be allowed to vote. And Susan B. Anthony, I believe, actually went and tried to vote.
Yeah,
did
she
vote.
Did. She got arrested.
And she was arrested.
Yeah.
So yeah, so then there was a court ruling, Minor versus Happersett, in which the Supreme Court ruled that the 14th Amendment did not apply to women. Mm-hmm. So they went ahead and said, like, no, that's not what we meant when we made that.
No, not for you.
Not for you. That's not what we meant. So the 19th Amendment was originally introduced to Congress in 1878 by Senator Aaron A. Sargent. 41 years later in 1919. So he introduced this in 1878. And it was not until 41 years later in 1919 that Congress submitted
it. That's good math, Keegan.
That is not my math. That's the internet's math. that Congress submitted it to the states for ratification, and it was ratified by 3/4 of the states a year later, so in 1920, with Tennessee's ratification being the last needed to add the amendment to the Constitution. So they had to get, like, a certain number of states in order for it to be ratified.
Right.
And they were able to get that number. In 1922, the Supreme Court rejected claims that the amendment was unconstitutionally adopted. So there were people in other states that were trying to say, hey, we still don't want women to have the right to vote. So it's unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court was like, no, it's not. Women get to vote. So sorry.
so suck my ass.
So basically, all these things that these women went through, and I know we've said a lot about their lack of intersectionality and kind of like the issues that some of these women had. But the point is, they're real people, and there was good and
real
bad.
Real flawed people.
And they were flawed, and they were also great. But no one can take away that these women were committed, dedicated. We wouldn't be where we are today had they not done what they did.
Yep.
And they went through some shit, man.
They
like,
did.
Because chaining themselves to the Capitol, I saw the instruments that they used, at least for the suffragettes in the United Kingdom, to force feed people whenever they were on hunger strike in prison.
Yeah.
And they're horrific. They're instruments of torture.
And yes, it isn't, while it is important to notice their downfalls, it is equally as important to celebrate the wonderful, amazing things that these women have done for us and that we're able to start for us, to start paving that road. And
right.
And that's why, to me, that's why I feel such a strong responsibility to make sure that what those women did is not done in vain. Mm-hmm.
You make sure you go out and vote.
And that you improve what they've done. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you're voting. And also look at their flaws, the things that they did wrong, and be able to notice that and say, no, I'm going to make sure that the way I live my life is different.
Right.
And that's what they're there for. They're there to just start, you know, they started digging the hole. We got to make it deeper. We got to make sure that we continue to create change and make things better for the world. And I mean,
and we have done that. And
I think we're gonna keep talking about that. But you know what? There's never the beautiful and tragic thing at the same time is that our work is never going to be done. And it's tragic because it's like, man, we're always going to have work to do. But at the same time,
I think that's also so beautiful, though.
It is beautiful because there's always going to be somebody I feel that I'm going to want to stand up for, and that I hope that the next generation feels that they want to stand up for and fight for.
And I think it's really cool that we're doing this series. So listeners, we've talked about this before, but if you don't know, every week for Women's History Month, we're going to cover a wave of feminism. So this week was the first wave, next week is the second wave, and so on. And I think what's really beautiful is also to recognize, of course, these people were products of their time, but they were also looking at the times in which they lived, and they were saying, what little bit of progress can we make?
Yes.
Can we move a little bit forward?
And how amazing is it that we are doing this at this time where I feel like when it comes to gun rights, it's such a hot topic, an important topic that's being discussed right now. And it's similar. It's what little progress can we make right now in a political world that is really fighting against us at this point? What little progress can we make? I can see these kids who are speaking right now being in our history books.
Oh, of course.
For the kids that
100% will be.
And we have to make sure that happens. And, you know, I hope that being doing this podcast, talking about what we like to talk about, advocating for what we believe in, I hope that that will make some sort of small change to have a chain reaction to be making bigger change in the world.
Yeah. And that's the point of all. I mean, like, that's the point of this. That's the point I think we were both trying to make about this first wave. Mm-hmm. In conclusion of the first wave is basically just saying they made whatever dent they could make at the time that they could make it. And it wasn't always perfect.
Nope.
But they paved the way for the people of the second and third and current wave.
Yep.
To come in. And without the people before us, we wouldn't be where we are.
Exactly.
Period.
Exactly.
You know, so yay.
Yay.
So props to them.
Fucking yay.
It's such an eloquent way to end that.
Well, I'm going to say, so I swear I give my mom a shout out every single episode.
Good. Why not?
Did you know that my mom, when she says goodbye to me on the phone, every single time now tells me to rage on?
That's the cutest thing I've ever heard. That's the cutest thing I've ever heard.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah.
I was just on the phone with her. So, okay, Keegan doesn't know this yet, but I thought we were supposed to be meeting at 6, not 6:30, so I looked at 5:30. And so I just, like, I went to a Starbucks.
Were you just sitting in your car?
No, okay, good. Okay, this is what happened. So I left early, and I was like, okay, I'm going to go to the Starbucks to get a markout on K-Cups, because when I'm at home, I'm lazy. I just want my Keurig or whatever. So I was like, eh, it's environmentally bad. And I'm like, oh, God, make me feel bad. So I went there to see if they had any of their Pike Rose K-Cups, and so I sat in the car, and I was, like, talking to my mom for a while to kind of, like, kill some time. Just got a new job, talking to her about that. And then I went in to, like, get my stuff, and I'm like, hey, Mom, I gotta go, I gotta go. And she's like, okay, rage on.
Oh, my God, that's the cutest thing.
It's so precious.
That's so sweet.
She sends me the longest text after each episode that she listens to, and she always says hi to you, by the way.
Oh, hi, Liz.
Hi, Liz.
I feel like I always say hi to Liz on the podcast.
No. Oy vey. I feel like when she visits next time, I'm just going to bring her and she's going to sit. She'll sit on the floor.
In the corner of the closet? That's so sad.
She'll love it. Oh my God. She had the biggest smile on her face the whole time. And we'll have her do the sign off.
Oh, yeah. That'd be awesome.
With that being said,
thank you guys all for listening.
Thank you.
That this episode was kind of all over the place.
But we are imperfect people.
We are imperfect people, and I'm getting ready to leave town, so Madigan and I are cramming in 2 episodes. And
we are.
So, you know, surprisingly, working a full-time job and everything else that's involved in life and doing research on 2 different episodes in 1 week may have been a little bit much, you know?
You know what? I'm feeling it.
I feel like I think I have this, like, incredible, I want to call it a flaw, but maybe it's not a flaw. I don't know. Maybe I should be more positive about it. But I do have this issue with myself where I'm just like, I feel like, yeah, I can say yes to everything and I'll find a way to fit it in. And then I'm overwhelmed.
Well, but I think that's the thing is quick 30-second background. I had originally thought of this podcast and this name and kind of, like, come to me. And the way that I wanted it to be was an approachable?
Too much liberated wine.
An approachable discussion of feminism from 2 people who are great friends and have much love for each other. And I want it to be for the everyday person to be able to listen to. We are not here to preach to you or to necessarily always give you the straight facts. And we are imperfect people. And every episode that we do is not going to be perfect. And to me, that's the beauty of it. Mm-hmm. I would rather be real with you guys and with each other and say, hey, look, we did our best this week. This is what we're doing. Than to try so hard and put pressure on ourselves to do something perfect every single time.
So hard.
But isn't that a better message
no,
to
I
send?
No, it is. It totally is.
You don't
is.
Have to be perfect.
It
it's
totally
fine.
Is.
We're
it's,
doing.
It's just my weird, like, type A-minus personality. Like,
I got you.
Insane.
Well, I'm here for you to support you. And I'm here for all of you guys to support you as well. Don't be perfect. It's boring.
That's fair. That is fair.
Yeah.
But we love you guys, and thank you for bearing with us, and thank you for kind of listening to us figure it out as we go. And it's so wonderful, and we appreciate it so much. Yeah. And yeah.
We encourage you
to rage on.
We'll get it eventually, I promise.
We'll get it eventually, and we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.